makes all the magic happen of transmitting efficiency and receiver capture area. Let me drop for a second. Once that antenna is electronically resonant, all of the radio magic happens. None of the books say this, and I'm very unhappy about this. You and I could build a half-wave dipole, Neil, out of, let me pick a number, 8-gauge wire. I want this thing to really be healthy. An 80-meter dipole, I'm building an 8-gauge wire. And it really weighs down my tree and gives me a lot of grief. And someday, I move to another location, and because I want the antenna to be visible, I build it out of 30-gauge wire instead of 8-gauge wire. And this is an 80-meter dipole. Believe it or not, the performance would be within half a dB of the same. The little bit of difference is the extra resistance of 132 feet of 30-gauge wire. There's lots of guys out there who built a stealthy antenna because the landlord didn't want to see it, and he built it out of 30-gauge wire. The effective area of the 30-gauge wire or the 8-gauge wire antenna is the same. And what's another funny thing, the formula that tells you the area of an antenna, gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. I'll say that slowly. Gain equals 4 pi a area over lambda squared, wavelength squared. You can solve that formula for area. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. I just rearranged the algebra if you don't want it. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Gain is something that you have control over. Lambda squared over 4 pi, that's a constant. So gain is a constant times area. That's it. It's got nothing to do with the diameter of the wire until you use wire that's so small in diameter that it builds up a whole lot of resistance. And if you're willing to silver plate the wire, maybe you can make that problem go away too. So I'll give you one other crazy example to show you how this really works in ways you would never expect. You use that formula, and that formula, in my opinion, Neil, is traceable to the National Bureau of Standards. It's part of the bedrock of the antenna science. Gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. That's the bedrock. When anybody builds a commercial or a military antenna testing range, he's working with that formula. You use that formula on your 80-meter dipole, ordinary half-wave dipole, you'll find out the real effective area of an 80-meter dipole is 8,500 square feet. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you look into that antenna from a long distance away, you look at it broadside, you would see this great big black oval in space with the dipole in the middle of it, and the area of that dipole would be 8,500 square feet. And the way you can apply that once you know it is that your Con Ed wire across the street, that's at the exact same altitude as your 80-meter dipole, and it's directly in the direction of the guy you want to talk to in London. And you say to yourself, Moy, that wire from Con Ed is casting a shadow onto my 80-meter dipole in the direction to London I want to talk to, and ain't going to work. Well, because the Con Ed wire is not resonant, the Con Ed wiring casts a shadow of a couple of square feet onto that great big black ellipse in space. That's the real area of your 80-meter dipole because of the magic of resonance. So a couple of square feet of shadow from the Con Ed wire on your 8,500 square feet means you've got 8,490 feet left, if you know what I mean. The real gain loss because of the Con Ed wire across the street at the exact same altitude is probably a tenth of a dB, and it would be difficult to measure. Opposite of common sense again. So this maybe will give you a little bit more of a feeling of what's going on. Antennas are not well taught in our good engineering schools. Many of the books don't tell you.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Many of the good antenna books do not tell you these secrets, Neil. And you're going to have to keep signing into the TechNet periodically, and John and I will give you a couple of one of these secrets each week that you sign in. And after you sign in enough time and you get enough credits for that particular class, you get a diploma. We're kidding you a little bit here, Neil. KD2, Charlie Mike Quebec, K2RIW in the TechNet. I hope that helps.
It helps immensely. So if I make it longer, that will compensate for the surface area, and does that include electronic length from a tuner?
You said if you make the antenna longer, you'll compensate. I'm not quite sure what you mean. matter how short or long you make it, I can make that 80-meter dipole that should be 132 feet long under normal circumstances. I could make it 160 feet long. I could make it 35 feet long. And I re-resonate it with my antenna tuner. In those two examples, I get essentially the exact same gain, the exact same pattern, the exact same effective area. You don't make it longer because you want to get more area out of it. Yeah, if you make the antenna multiple wavelengths long, now another phenomena comes along, and you can look at the ARL antenna book, and you'll find out if you make the dipole 3 half wavelengths, 5 half wavelengths, 4 wavelengths, and whatever, you get a different pattern. You get lobes in space in funny areas that are very predictable. So as you make the antenna very long compared to a half wavelength, you get this other pattern, and maybe that's the pattern you want, but in general, within the half wavelength category, or if you go to Krauss's book on antennas and you read the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole, let me drop. You can make the dipole smaller and smaller and smaller, as long as you've used low loss materials and you keep re-resonating it electronically, you'll keep coming back to the exact same gain. So making it longer doesn't give you a benefit until you make it multiple half wavelengths long and you develop these other lobes in space. You start developing another antenna pattern. And that's a very predictable phenomenon. And as I said, you look at the appropriate chapter of ARL's antenna book and you'll see those patterns and you can decide if you like one of those and you want to duplicate it. KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, K2RIW. Go ahead, Neil.
I'm sorry, I kind of worded that poorly. I meant if you make it the right electronic length to resonate, that's what matters.
There's a yes and a no to that. If you make it longer so that you hit electronic resonance with the physical size, now you have the option of not using an antenna tuner. If you're going to make it far away from the normal physical size of a half wavelength dipole, for instance, then yes, you're forced into an antenna tuner. If I take that 132 foot long half wave dipole and 80 meters, and for whatever reason, maybe my property is not big enough, I can only build 79 feet of it instead of 132. And if you go to the right chapter of Antenna Engineering Handbook, the Brown and Woodward curve, or you go to the K2RIW article, which will show you those curves, you can find out exactly what impedance you're going to get. I'm going to make a guess here. 79 feet of wire instead of 132 feet on 80 meters. It probably is 40 ohms of resistive component and probably 1,500 ohms of capacitive component. As an antenna, that impedance is very difficult to live with. And if you don't do something funny, you'll have a standing wave ratio of 40 to 1. Use your antenna tuner, and that 79 feet of wire is brought back into electronic resonance. And now looking into the antenna tuner, you'll see 50 ohms of a resistor. So what happens when you don't hit exactly half wave electronically with the physical length, you get a crazy impedance. The antenna tuner creates, and it's a predictable number, but the antenna tuner corrects that crazy impedance. You think it's an impedance match when you're using your antenna tuner. It really is re-resonating as well as impedance matching. Wonder if that makes a little more sense, Neil. KD2CMQ, K2RIW.
Yes, it does, thanks. I just realized I'm going to spend a lot more money on an antenna tuner. Thank you.
That's one approach. However, You can write a check and make the problem go away and buy a real Cadillac antenna tuner. That's one approach. The other approach is that my property is not big enough. I've only got 79 feet of wire. I go to the Brown and Woodward curve, which, by the way, you'll find by going to... I can't think of the call letters right now of Tom Williams. WA1MBA. WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. You go to that website, the microwave website of Dr. Tom Williams. At the bottom of that website, you'll see these Yagi impedance matching article by K2RIW. You go to that article, and you'll see a curve, a set of curves. Those two curves will tell you my 79 feet of wire has this exact impedance. The curve will tell you that, the resistive component, the reactive component. You then go to the Berkeley program. You Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, and they will find you the Berkeley program. You tell it the exact impedance of that antenna, and you press go. 5 seconds later, Berkeley will give you 16, count them, 16 solutions. An L network, a T network, a Pi network, an LT, and whatever. You choose the right inductor in microhenries, the right capacitor in picofarads, plug it into that diagram that the Berkeley program tells you, and you've impedance matched that antenna perfectly at the antenna. And those components are going to cost you a couple of dollars. If you're smart enough, you don't have to buy the antenna tuner if you want to save the money. The choice is yours. So you got multiple choices here. Back to you for any clarity on any repeats on any of that, Neil. Wait for the four beeps. KD2CMQ, K2LAW.
No, thank you, Dick. I think that pretty much covers it.
And by the way, Neil, antennas are kind of magic. The books don't make it clear. There's not enough books that do make it clear. And as you go through the learning curve, and you're going to hit some successes, some failures, and whatever, come back and tell us what you find. Because you'd be amazed how many people are in your exact boat where you are right now. You're not alone. Okay, the next person, I think, is another Neil. Or is it Warren? I'm not sure now. Whiskey 2, November, Dolph. I may be confusing things here. Whiskey 2, November, Delta Golf. I think that was a real person with a question. K2LAW, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, it's Neil. Whiskey 2, November, Delta Golf, and I do have a question. First, I'll tell you that I took measurements in a bunch of places when I was out shoveling, and we had anywhere from 19 to 40-odd inches outside because of the drifting. But they tell us that this area got 26 inches. So let me drop, and I do have a question, an antenna question in two parts. Funny enough, my question is kind of related to the other Neil's question. So I know that people make Yagis out of tape measures. I've seen them. I know some of the Limark members even have them, and they work. When you're making a Yagi or a similar antenna, with elements that are very thin like that, is there a limit to how thin you can go with the elements before you have issues? And what I'm thinking about is, and I know people have done this because I've researched it a little bit, is making an antenna out of alarm tape, the type of tape they used to use on the windows, the foil tape, for the older burglar alarms before they had the brake sensors. I'm looking to make an antenna possibly out of alarm tape, and then I'll get into what type of antenna after you answer the first part.
Yeah, as you start making an antenna out of a wide, thin substance instead of a round piece of wire, in cross-section, you and I start worrying about the fact that, hey, there's not very much meat there, and how's the RF going to behave? Because the actual cross-section is so small in wavelengths, the radio wave can't tell the difference if it's round, square, flat, thin, and whatever, as long as it has the right conductivity. So if, by way of the right kind of instrumentation, where you can measure the number of ohms per foot, or whatever material you're using to make out of an antenna, make into an antenna, as long as the number of ohms per foot is a low enough number that it's not really a resistive load, that it really is a conductor, it's going to fly. And as you make it wider, you do pick up a slight improvement in bandwidth. And when it comes to tape Yagis, which can easily be folded up, put into a tube, thrown into the trunk of a car, used for a portable location or whatever, let me drop it. There was a beautiful article about 6 months ago published in the monthly journal of the Rochester Amateur Radio Club, RAG, R-A-G, Rochester Amateur Radio Group, okay. I remember sending a copy of that to Jim, KD2BHY, a beautiful article. And if you like, I'll try to find you that again. In other words, these guys in Rochester do a whole lot of fox hunting and some kind of a competition where the portable antenna, they go running around in the field trying to find a transmitter within a given length of time. It's a kind of orienteering and camping out in the woods and using these antennas that are really rugged, made out of the steel tapes that that are sold in Harbor Freight or whatever, or Home Depot. So you can get a very high performance Yagi out of those steel tapes. So don't worry about the thinness. Worry about the ohms per foot. And once the ohms per foot is a low enough number, the antenna's going to fly. Neil, go ahead with the rest of your question. W2, November, Delta Golf. And by the way, all those inches of snow you got, you live in Northern Huntington. And Northern Huntington got, in theory, 29 inches. I'm in Southern Huntington, and I got between 18 and 20. Still a whole lot of shoveling. Over to you, Neil. W2NDG, K2LIW.
Dick, yes, my back will agree with you. Here's part two. I'm familiar with Moxon antennas and the design and how they work laid out horizontally. I had read that you can use them vertically, but my question is, what is the correct orientation to use a Moxon vertically? Is it long ways where the antenna would be stretched out over a horizontal pattern with the short end being on the sides, or flipped the other way where the antenna would be up and down in a vertical fashion? What's the correct orientation for a Moxon used vertically?
I'm going to ask you a question first, because I'm a little bit unsure on this one. I think it was the Moxon that I researched recently. Is that the one that looks like a clothesline? In other words, it's got the something like six bars going out from the center, and they're bent up into a parabolic shape, and then there's wires in between those bars. Is that the antenna we're talking about here? Neil, go ahead.
A Moxon is kind of like a bent dipole with a parasitic element forming the shape of a rectangle with a break on the short ends. So it, the overall shape of the antenna is a rectangle. There's a feed point halfway through one of the long sides. There's a break of a very specific measurement on the short sides. And then the parasitic element is a solid piece that is the other long side.
Yeah, almost every one of these antennas of the type that you're describing has a very predictable polarization depending on where you feed it. Very similar to what happens with a cubicle quad. If I've got a cubicle quad where one of the sides is parallel to the ground and I feed the middle of that side, by definition, I'm horizontally polarized. If I feed one of the vertical bars in the middle, I'm vertically polarized. Horizontal if I feed that horizontal bar. If I set it at the 90 degree corner, I'm slant polarized, slant 45 degree polarization. So where you feed it almost always determines the polarization. So once you know, I wish I had a little bit better memory now as to what the Moxon looks like. Once you know where you're feeding it, even if it zigzags in funny ways, and in your case it's a rectangle, and I sense that the rectangle is thin in one dimension and quite long in the other dimension, once you know where you're feeding it, it defines the polarization, and therefore to take whatever polarization is conventional, and you take that whole physical structure and rotate it to get another desired polarization, that's very doable. And in some cases, you can find another way of feeding it to get the other polarization. So I'm going to have to look up Moxon again. My memory is a little bit poor on this one, Neil. But I know it's doable. And I guess for physical reasons, you want to mount it differently, or you want a different polarization is what I think is going on here. W2NDG, K2LIW in the TechNet.
B3ZDZ with info.
Stand by a minute there, Neil. Hey, Scott. Bet you've got a lot more familiarity with this. Bring me up to speed. VE3ZTZ8URIW. You got it, Scott. From Toronto.
Yeah, for the gentleman asking the question, just for reference, I've got two VHF locks on, sitting on little tripods, pointing out my windows. I'm a vertical cave dweller. The directivity, which I think was the root of your question, the radiator that you feed is the forward direction. And the single element that is the, what you're referring to is the parasitic element, which is capacitively coupled, which is why the measurements in the brake on the short sides are so critical. That's the reflector. So you want to point where your coax, the two elements that you attach your coax to, that's your forward direction. Oriented vertically and point the fed, the driver element, out the window.
Okay, I'm looking up Moxon right now. I've seen it once before, and I'm very unhappy I can't remember it. I hope that's helpful, Neil. And if not, you're allowed to come back and ask the question again. And I'm going to try to refresh my memory as to what the Moxon looks like. W2NDG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Pretty much answered my question. I'd like to thank, it was Scott, I think. And I'm probably just going to go ahead and create this thing because it's going to be a rather inexpensive experiment. I want to make a roll-up portable Moxon out of a sheet of semi-rigid plastic and alarm tape and see how that works as a portable that I can just hang on something. So, anyway, thanks a lot, and I'll let you know how it goes when I finally get it together. W2NDG, back to net.
And then one of the things I think you should consider is either doing it again or maybe make a decision as to whether or not you follow the advice of the Rochester Amateur Radio Group, RAG, and where they use these carpenter's tapes, metal tapes, expandable tape type ruler into a three or four element Yagi. Very successful, so successful that the whole Don Club built about 20 of these or 30 of these. They got together one day and built 20 or 30 of them, and they're all flying, and they go out there and have a lot of fun with them. I'm going to try to find that article for you, Neil, and mail it to you. I presume if I use W2NDG at ARRL.net, that would be a website for you. Is that true, Neil?
I think I have the forwarding set up for that, or at Landmark.org will work.
Very fine, Neil. Okay, good luck with that project. Let us know how that goes. Let's see, the next person on the list, I think, was Warren. Kilo Delta 2, Delta India November, K2RIW. Go ahead, Warren.
Okay, thank you. Yes, the call here is KD2DIN. I have a quick question for the TechNet. I purchased some DXE400 Max, DUO50. And last week, I believe in the TechNet, you got me thinking. You said that you'd much prefer a certain type of RG8 cable than the gas-injected foam polyethylene. Could you just repeat what you said?
Sure can, Warren. And this all comes from a personal experience of a very serious antenna. The biggest antenna I ever built was 16, count them, 16 Yagis on 432, 19 elements each. This was an antenna on top of 100 feet of tower. If you ever get a chance to see my QSL card, I'm standing in the middle of this antenna, and this thing dwarfs me. This whole total array was, 16 feet wide, 16 feet high, 13 feet deep. It's something like 3,500 cubic feet of antenna, 304 elements on 432, being fed with what I thought was the Cadillac of cables in its day. This was way back in 1980. An FM8 made by ITT was a real good cable. Outer thick jacket of polyethylene, foam-filled cable, very low insertion loss. Let me drop. And the antenna worked like a charm for the first couple of years. And very slowly it degraded, and I didn't realize it. I got used to it each day. And when Hurricane Gloria in 1985 brought that antenna down and deposited the whole damn array into my front yard, I took it upon, I decided to re-measure those cables, and I measured a tremendous amount of insertion loss of each of these foam-filled cables. What had happened, and it wasn't just because I had leaking water at the end of one of the connectors, I had a total of 16 Yagis there, about 18 or 20 cables altogether in between all those power dividers and so on, all carefully weatherproofed. Every one of the cables had the exact same increase in insertion loss. What had happened is that I didn't recognize the difference between hermetic seal and weather seal. The outer polyethylene jacket is a real good weather seal. For the first year or so, it does a pretty good job of keeping out the water. But very slowly, water vapor migrates through that outer polyethylene jacket, gets into the foam. And as you've been hearing us say for the last few TechNets, water is an extremely lossy substance. And therefore, the foam-filled cable, a flexible foam-filled cable outdoors, in many cases will slowly absorb water. And in my case, those cables, each one of those phasing harness cables, either went 3 times or 4 times higher in insertion loss because of the water that got absorbed. Let me drop. As such, the bottom line is that hardline cable with foam filled, beautiful, as long as they're doing a good job of sealing the ends. And maybe there are some cables these days which have a real good solid foil on the outer braid, under or over the outer braid, underneath the polyethylene jacket, which maybe the foil gives you a good metallic seal so that water can't get in. But if it's an ordinary braided foam-filled cable with polyethylene jacket, my experience is that it's going to give you an increased insertion loss over the next couple of years, and you'll be very unhappy about it. So hardline avoids the problem, and therefore the flexible cable, which I've got to use going around the rotator, I use something with the polyethylene or Teflon as the dielectric, a solid dielectric, not a foam-filled dielectric. I suffered a little bit of extra loss in order to get longevity, so that the flexible cable, in my case, I use either RG8, RG214, RG9, one of the ones with solid polyethylene, which can absorb water. Because if the water vapor gets into the foam by any means, the insertion loss will climb significantly, precipitously, to use it as a pun, if you know what I mean. That's a bunch of opinions, and I've suffered with that, and now you know where it's coming from. Those strong opinions are Warren. KD2DIN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Zick, I appreciate that information. I think I'll, before getting this up on the roof, I had purchased this from a local, DX Engineering. It was a 50-foot piece. And I think the engineer talked me into it. They call it a 400 max CBL. You're probably familiar with it. But I get the feeling that I'm going to go another route now. I thank you for the information. The location is Port Washington, 9 inches of snow. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, you guys in Nassau did a little bit better than we did in Suffolk. As you go to the center of Suffolk and you go toward the North Shore, boy, did they get snow. John, KC2WGB, only got 4 inches out there in Staten Island. So 9 inches in Port Washington. That's where my grandfather used to have his farm, in Port Washington. I think I've gone down the list of the people who signed in with a question. I hope I didn't skip anybody, and if so, we'll now go over to the next thing that we promise each week, and that is the mailbag, the space net, and then we'll get into the serious stuff. Let me stand by and make sure I haven't skipped anybody. K2RIW.
NY2H.
Go right ahead, Lou.
All right, just a very quick comment just to wrap it up on these antennas, and some of them are a little bit confused about them. So if I were to string a wire up my tree vertically at a half wave and fed it, and, heat smashed it, you're saying it would be a hand-fed half-wave dipole. Now, what would be the difference between that and a half-wave vertical? The fact that I have, a grounding on the vertical on the other side, and how would I, could I feed it with twin lead? A little bit confused about the two.
When the average person talks about a vertical antenna, 90-some-odd% of the time, Lou, they're talking about a quarter-wave ground plane antenna. And in order for that to work efficiently, it takes a zillion ground plane radials, because those ground plane radials are trying to act like an infinite sheet of metal that's acting like a perfect reflector. So if the quarter wave resonator above ground has a mirror reflection in that sheet of metal, which is the other quarter wave below ground, so to speak, and rather than put down all of those crown plane radials on a quarter wave resonator, if you now make the radiator mechanically a half wavelength long, in the vicinity of a half wavelength long, plus or minus a little bit, that you're willing to impedance match. Now the need for the ground plane radials almost disappears, because instead of, in the case of a quarter wave ground plane, at the base you're feeding something like a 30 ohm impedance, 35 ohm impedance, and you've got to have this reflecting property where you've got a zillion ground plane radials. In the case of a half wave resonator, the real resonator is there. You're feeding a, let me pick a number, 1500 ohm impedance. You're not trying to make this mirror image anymore. And because it's a much higher impedance, in many cases, a simple ground rod is all you need for the counterpoise. Let me drop. And you pick up about three benefits. Number one, a zillion ground plane radials are not required. In fact, a number of guys, even with a helically wound half-wave radiator, used as a counterpoise the metal railing of the balcony of their apartment. The metal railing of the balcony was more than good enough, and the antenna flew like a charm. So half-wave resonator, whether it be the vicinity of half-wave, which you and I call 5/8 wave mag mount, so to speak, or a real half-wave radiator with the railing as the counterpoise, or a ground rod, or put a bunch of ground plane radials if it'll make you feel better, but you don't need to. So it's a simpler antenna to feed. You're feeding it from one end. You're feeding a high impedance. Ground plane radials are not required. And the phase center of the antenna is higher off the ground. On HF frequencies, that makes a difference. So vertical polarization gives you all kinds of benefits when it comes to low angle of radiation. Higher altitude gives you benefits. Feeding the higher impedance gives you much easier mechanical layout, so you don't need the ground plane radials. The price that you pay is you're now going to put an impedance matching network in there, because you're feeding 1,500 ohms instead of 35 ohms in the case of a quarter wave, or if you're feeding the center of a half wave dipole, you're feeding 70 ohms. So you can see there's a bunch of pluses and minuses, but the pure half wave vertical, fed from the bottom or the center, if it makes you feel more comfortable, is an antenna, in my opinion, that has not been given the notoriety that it's due. It can be an extremely high-performance antenna. The rare guy who builds one says, will say, wow, this thing is better than baked bread. Why hasn't somebody told me about it sooner? NY28.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
NY2H, K2RIW. Go ahead, Lou.
Comment.
Lou first, and then we'll pick up a noisy comment. Go ahead, Lou.
All right, very fine. Yeah, I would like to try this because this sounds really good. I have a tree, and I can throw up a vertical there, and, you know, I'll do the impedance matching. Very attractive. And the only other question I might have is that mag mount 38-inch antenna for 2 meters I have on my car roof. They call it a vertical. Now, unless it's collinear and they're doing something in between, and there is a little coil, but I thought that was because it was dual band. I guess there is such a thing as a halfway vertical also, so I'm not really clear on that. But go back to the other station and maybe just a quick sentence or two on that. Over back to that.
Yeah, there are a number of mag mounts for 2 meters, for instance, and some of them happen to be dual band, and it complicates things. But I could take a pure 2 meter single band mag mount that claims to be either 5/8 wave or half wave. In either case, you'll see a loading coil at the bottom. Usually it's a printed circuit built into the mag mount itself. That is the L network, that is the impedance step-up thing that's feeding the 1500 ohms. It would be feeding a pure 1500 ohm resistor if it was exactly a half wavelength long, because in some cases you get a tiny bit more gain by going a little bit beyond half wave toward 5/8 wave. It's now not only a 1500 ohm impedance, but it's a little bit inductive, as I remember. I think it's inductive. And that coil electronically inserts another almost quarter wave to bring it up 3/4 waves, where it becomes a fairly easy to meet impedance. So that coil in the bottom is the impedance matching network. Whether or not it's also correcting some reactive impedance as well as the high impedance resistance, those are minor details. So mag mounts of half wave or 5/8 wave are in general higher in performance, very desirable, and a hell of a lot better than a quarter wave, in my opinion. So, it was, why can't I think of his name right now? The guy who there's a number of guys who have had pure vertical half wave dipole, a simple green piece of wire, so to speak, in an evergreen tree out in front of the house, and boy, it works like a charm. The person with comment, please start off with your full set of call letters and your name, and then your comment, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Okay, who is the person who said comment, comment? Go right ahead. I'll try you one more time. I'm hearing a person on the input who is not coming through the machine. Maybe he doesn't have the right TL tone. I'm hearing a person on input who says, is he making it? And on the input, yes. Through the machine, no. Who was that? Now he's not there. That was Mel, K2KEY. My mind went blank. He's only been with me for 5 years before he became a silent key last year. He's the guy with the green piece of wire and the evergreen tree out in front of his house in Manhattan Beach and Brooklyn, and he was very happy with that antenna. Okay, let's go to the mailbag. John?
LIM with another, I guess, a comment.
LIM with a comment? Go right ahead.
Okay, my name is Brendan. I've been in the hobby for a little while, and I've been in and out of it for various reasons. And one of the reasons is frustration. The class I sat in for to get my initial license taught me to pass the basic test. There was absolutely no help for equipment selection, setup, operation, and most of all, how to program a radio. I've asked that I belong to LIMOC, and that's right from the beginning. And I've asked some of the early instructional sessions be directed to programming various radios. I've had an ICOM 706, which I loved, and one of the new inexpensive Chinese radios. The reason I bought the Chinese radio was I thought I knew it came with a disc, and it would be probably easy to program. I still have no idea how to program a radio, and I really need help. I'm sure that I'm not alone. And I wonder, how do we proceed to help those of us who need this help? And this is really a request for help. And then I won't bother you anymore, but it would be really a wonderful thing. I've learned how to solder connections, and Wednesday I'll learn how to crimp connections. But what I really need to know is how to program the radio so I can get on the air. And I'm sorry to be so long.
Brandon, you're not alone. The user-friendliness of many of our radios leaves a lot to be desired. And they're not universal. In other words, the big three, Kenwood, ICOM, Yaesu, and a whole lot of other brands, you'd like to believe in the way you go to a menu and a submenu of brand A would be the same that you do with brand B. And they've each got their own favorite way of doing things. So therefore, learning how to program one radio helps you very little when it comes to learning how to program another radio. For a short period of time, there was a beautiful company, I wish I remember where they were located, which sold these little white cards, let me call it a crimp sheet or a cheat sheet. And the card would have, for each model and brand name of radio, it would tell you in a very simple form how to program the thing. And you put that on some kind of a little keychain, and you put that on the radio, so to speak, and it's a hell of a lot easier to use than the owner's manual. In many cases, the owner's manual is written in Japanese English or Chinese English, if you know what I mean, and it loses a lot in the translation. Quite often, very respected companies, just to choose another whole area, handheld calculators, for instance, and other instruments, like a real Cadillac of a company, in my opinion, was Hewlett-Packard. And the manuals they used to write, well, they were really written for easy understanding. Unfortunately, the bean counters took over the company. The owner's manual and the repair manual was written by another outsourced company that only partially understood the product, and therefore what you got was very difficult to use. And so you're in good company, Brandon. A lot of people are having the problem you're talking about. I don't know what the answer is. There is something called the computer net on Limark. Maybe that would help a little bit. And each one of the radios, eventually you'll find a guy who fell in love with that particular radio, and he becomes a quasi-expert. And if you can pick his brain, he knows the innards of how the thing really works. That's one possible approach. Once you've got a brand and model number radio, try to find an expert. And hams in general are very good at helping each other. But you've got a very universal problem. Let me pass it over to the net and see if anyone else has a suggestion as to how do you get around the difficulty of programming these radios with all of the damn submenus. And in many cases, the modern-day radio doesn't have anywhere near enough push buttons anymore. And therefore, you have to go to a menu inside of a menu inside of a menu in order to get to the function. And the owner's manual doesn't make it clear how you get to that function, what's the proper protocol to use it, what do you get after you use it. Anybody's got any suggestions for a solution, please give me your call. That is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2MDP.
Okay, I heard MDP, and he doubled with another person. Who was the other person?
PV.
Okay, MDP first, and then we'll go to John second. MDP, you got it.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Name here is Steve, just in case you forgot or anybody else forgot. Try YouTube. They have a lot of useful videos there that sort of walk you through the programming of these radios. I recently bought a Kenwood radio, a commercial type radio, and I have the booklet. Of course, I lost it. I don't know where I put it. And I looked on YouTube, and basically they walk you right through it. So YouTube might be a good place to start. Back to you.
To NDG, Thomas.
NDG recognized. We're going to go to John first. John first, go ahead.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick. There's user groups that he can find on the net, especially like Dorbson. If he has the programming cable and the disk, he gets on there, within an hour, he'll be all set. It's really not that hard.
Q-G-S. Okay, Bill recognized. We're going to go to Neil first. W2NDG, go ahead, Neil.
I believe he mentioned that he was going to be learning how to crimp connectors on Wednesday, which means he's going to the Limark meeting. Our vice president, Jay, KC2, I think, YSK? I'm messing up his call sign, I'm sorry. But Jay, if he's listening, he can chime in. Jay did a presentation on a piece of software called Chirp, which makes the whole programming process a lot easier. And if you're having trouble getting the software to work, there are the drivers, sometimes getting those programming cables working on your computer can be a little tricky. And we've got plenty of people in the club that can help out with that, too. So I would ask at the meeting on Wednesday, see if Jay's there. If not, I think you'll find plenty of other people who have used Chirp before and can tell you where to get it and how to use it. Back to that.
Another good suggestion. Thank you, Neil. Bill, your signal was a little bit noisy, but I think we're going to pull you out. WB2QG's in. Microwave voice of Massapequa, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, yep, not in a great spot to his location from before. Real quick, if So that station can't get a hand from the Limewall folks at the meeting Wednesday. The Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club has an in-person open house, help out session sort of affair every Wednesday evening and Saturday morning down at the town of Abilene, EOC, on Sunrise Highway. And you can just come on down there and pick up the folks who are in the program in those radios, and they'll hook you right up.
Okay, so the EOC, Emergency Operations Center, Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club, sounds like they're very helpful along these lines. See if Brandon needs any fill-in in the above. Go ahead, Brandon, K2LIW.
Well, first of all, I have to say that it's so gratifying to hear so many people jump in to try to help. It's like the old Elmering system, and I'm really pleased. I really think it would be great. The only thing I didn't catch was the Wednesday time for the Great South Bay sessions.
Okay, Bill, you're going to have to give us a repeat. Your signal was a little bit noisy, so speak slowly or move to the right location, Bill, and tell us of those times. WB2QGZ, K2LIW.
Yes, I would double check on website, but if I had to take a stab, I'd say about 7:30 or 8 o'clock, 7:30 or 8 o'clock on Wednesday, and Saturday morning usually, depending if it is a test session or not, somewhere between, say, around 10, 11 o'clock, give or take. You can also reach out at a repeater, the Great South Bank Club, the repeater PHF, and they'll let you know if somebody's down there. And I think we'll do the best I can here.
Very fine, Bill. You were there 80% of the time. So when you go to the Great South Bay website, it'll give you all of that information. Very similar to the Limewall website. Tells you exact hours and days and who is the net control and whatever of these nets. So good luck with that, Brendan. And let us know what you find out as you find out the programming. Okay, let's go to the mailbag, John, KC2WGB. What kind of burning questions did we get this week? And I think we got one left over from last week. You got it, John, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. Yes, we have a few antenna questions. Okay, let me let it drop. Okay, a gentleman wants to build a radio direction finding loop. He has an old degaussing coil, which is approximately 13 inches in diameter. This is going to be for 2 meters. Now, what he wants to do is wind a coil and place it inside of this plastic structure. Nice little structure. And he'd like to know what kind of wire, what size, how many turns, and should he mount a tuning capacitor on the antenna itself, or would it be mounted inside of the radio or maybe at the antenna input? Maybe you can give him a few words on that construct. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
I'm a little bit sorry to say, John, I'm not going to be able to give him as many words as you'd like. There's a little bit of an exotic art when it comes to a direction-finding loop. Most of the designs of direction-finding loop do some funny things by normal antenna technology, such that you're trying to get, in many cases, what's called a cordioid pattern. In other words, the pattern is kind of a heart-shaped pattern where you get at least a deep null in one direction. So you're doing funny things with the loop and the way you feed it, so you get a null in one direction. Ordinarily, a loop antenna is bi-directional, and so to direction-find with it gives you a 2-to-1 ambiguity. You'll know that the guy is either to the north or to the south. Well, if you're trying to direction find, you'd really like to know is he north or south, not that he's one of the two and that he's not east or west. And so there are ways that you can make the north get nulled compared to the south, so to speak. My recommendation is that you do some web search and you do look at the appropriate chapter of the AR Oil antenna book and some other antenna books under the subject of direction-finding loop. So if you take the design, one of the respected designs, and without making a whole lot of substitutions, you follow the design, hopefully you'll get that null in the pattern. and you get rid of this this 2-to-1 ambiguity, and you have a real direction finding loop. As you can tell, the exact method by which you get that null right now is not clear to me, so I can't help as much as you'd like. Let me find out if anyone else has built direction finding loops and can give us some words on that. Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. Yeah, I was a little bit afraid of that. As you can tell, that is a rather separate art in antennas. The art that goes into direction finding, particularly a direction finding loop, you want to follow somebody's exact design, if you know what I mean. And as I said, make very few substitutes if you want to get the same performance he got. There's more to it than first meets the eye, I can tell you that much. I know I didn't give much of an answer on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, he was looking to build a basic one. He understands there'll be a 180-degree ambiguity with the one he's going to build, but he can resolve that by translating the receiver. So he was just wondering, like, basically, would it be 100 turns, 150 turns of a certain type of wire? What would be, like, the minimum amount of turns you would suggest? And then he could work maybe developing something from the basic system that he builds.
Okay. I was a little bit afraid to go into that one because I could tell that something was funny. When it comes to a 2-meter antenna, 144 to 148 megacycle region, a loop antenna in that region usually is a small fraction of a wavelength in circumference. If you started off with 13 inches of diameter, already it's kind of big, and then you put multiple turns of it, wow, you're way beyond the usual length for resonance. Most antennas, you resonate them first before they radiate well. And so a 13-inch diameter loop, multiple turns, I think not. So something is wrong there. Multiple turns of 13-inch diameter would be an appropriate antenna if I'm building a loop for 1 megacycle, not 140 megacycles. So there's about a 100-to-1 ratio of something in error here, as you can tell, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. So I think he should do exactly what you said. He should start with the ARL information and maybe do some Googling. I'm sure he'll come up with dozens of those antennas. But he didn't want to make it complicated, but just the fact that it's going to be well oversized at 13 inches. I don't think it's going to fly too well near 200 megahertz. So, okay, very good. Let me go to the next.
Question about this.
Go ahead, Wes.
You could clarify. I think it's not quite clear whether you're dealing with the loop antenna that is a fraction of the wavelength for the given frequency, or multi-length of the wavelength, 10 times, 20 times, whatsoever. I believe it's worth to point to what is going on with the efficiency and other parameters.
If I'm building a dipole, just as an example, and I build it a half wavelength long, it has an extremely predictable pattern. And if I could see that pattern in three-dimensional space, it would look like a donut. With the wire going through the center of the hole is a donut, and broadside to that wire is where you get maximum signal strength. That's where the donut is at the maximum diameter. That's a half wavelength dipole. As I start making the dipole multiple wavelengths long, that three-dimensional pattern starts developing multiple lobes, not one simple lobe. The donut pattern, I'm calling it one lobe, when you display it in the normal manner on a flat sheet of paper. You make a cut through the three-dimensional pattern, you display it on a flat piece of paper, and you could say there's a lobe to the north and a lobe to the south if the wire is east-west. But those lobes become multiple lobes when you make it multiple wavelengths long. A loop antenna has a similar characteristic. The average person who builds a horizontally polarized loop antennas, would like it to have omnidirectional characteristics. He'd like it to be able to listen to a horizontal signal to the north, south, east, and west. To do that, he usually makes the loop a small fraction of a wavelength long, so that the current around the loop is nearly constant, and it's way high in resonance, but he re-resonates it with the impedance matching network. As you make the loop multiple wavelengths in circumference, with one turn or multiple turns, but you make it multiple wavelengths in circumference, again, you develop loops all over the place. It's not a simple pattern anymore. And so this may be a reason why you want to have that more complicated pattern, but that many people don't. And it's a predictable pattern, but it's complicated.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And not many books will show you a multiple wavelength circumference loop, what the pattern looks like, because very few people have ever built it. And again, your main function of making an efficient antenna, efficient meaning that it has a relatively low standing wave ratio for your particular transmission line. Whenever people talk about antenna efficiency, you got to be careful how you use that word. To an antenna engineer, efficiency means if I put 100 watts into the antenna, does 99 watts get radiated into space somewhere? Then that's an efficient antenna. If I put 100 watts in the antenna and 90 watts gets dissipated as heat and the antenna gets hot and only 10 watts gets radiated, that's an inefficient antenna. There are lots of people who make the mistake of saying that, well, I didn't get the gain that I want. I expected 13 dB of gain. I only got 10 dB of gain. That's half the gain I expected to get. Therefore, the antenna was 50% inefficient. That's a thorough misunderstanding of the word efficiency. Because that 10 dB gain antenna, when you expected 13, even though it has less gain, which means it's got a broader beamwidth and a different pattern from the one you expected, still you put 100 watts into it, 99 watts is being radiated into space. And therefore, to an antenna engineer, you're misusing the word efficiency. One last point on this one.
The size matters. It's going to have a small one.
If I'm building an antenna where I really want the antenna to first resonate, since resonance is so important, to have it multiple wavelengths long, which makes it very difficult to re-resonate it and still have a simple pattern, very few people will make an antenna multiple wavelengths in circumference and use multiple turns when it's not required. You only use multiple turns if it's required because you're on such a low frequency and you want to use a reasonable size capacitor to make it hit resonance. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, though, Wes. In 2XJN, K2RIW?
It does. Two points that are important to in here. One of them is you're going to have an antenna that will have a wavelength that will match 14 megahertz frequency, and it will be a coil. There will be two coils. There will be a dipole, and you can have the same dipole that would be spread with not coiled the arms of the dipole, but stretched out. And it's a significant difference between that. Both of them will dissipate the 99 watts of the power I've delivered. I can bet for it. And so it's here.
I'm going to challenge that, Wes. You've used good common sense, and it's led you astray, I think. Let's just choose, for craziness, an 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, straight-out piece of wire. I could decide, because my balcony on my apartment is so small, that I'm going to build it 10 feet long instead of 132 feet long, and it's going to be a helical wound dipole. Tightly wound helix for the right-hand side of the dipole and the left-hand side of the dipole. And by way of the helical winding, maybe with an impedance matching network, I make this short thing on my balcony hit resonance on 80 meters. You would think that antenna is going to have a smaller effective capture area, and lower gain. You would think so. Absolutely not. If I built it out of good materials, that small antenna will be high in Q. It'll be very narrowband,